Hello, welcome back to a very special episode of the Creative Weirdos podcast. I have back for the second time the first returning guest, Rob Christofferson of the Our Strange Skies podcast, and we're talking about a super special project we started doing called Welcome UFO People. It's a monthly one-page comic covering all kinds of UFO encounters, anomalous encounters, and just awesome strangeness that Rob has researched and dug up for me to draw. So yeah, we get into the idea behind this little project, the comics history of both of us, and a whole bunch of weird stuff that's just really fun and imaginative, and one of my favorite conversations I've had in a super long time. So enjoy the stories. Rob tells some real good ones, and check out the artwork on Instagram and Twitter at Welcome UFO People. Hope you have a wonderful Halloween weekend, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a great day. Bye. But it's good. Have you tried to mess with the transcription thing at all? I always see that it has them now, and I'm like, does that actually work?
Yeah, it does. It works pretty well. It takes a while, but like the AI is pretty good on it. I've perused through them before, and yeah, they're pretty solid. You know, they're not too many mistakes, but
yeah, no.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, Rob, I'm real stoked to talk to you a little bit today about our new project that we got going on here. You've been, I guess since we've been chatting on Instagram, you've been sending me just some of my favorite images associated with these UFO and anomalous encounters that, I mean, a lot of them are witness drawings that are just amazing for their own kind of, there's something really genuine and beautiful about them, but I really love the ones that are more illustrative and in that kind of classic comic style. And yep. Yeah, ever since you started doing that, I've wanted to kind of do a project where I illustrate some of these things. But obviously, writing, and especially in like documenting actual encounters and stuff, has never been my strong suit. So I was so stoked when we kind of landed on the idea of you writing out some 5-panel comics here for me to draw. So yeah, essentially, I think we just kind of, I don't even remember who asked who, but I was like, we should do this. And then we did it.
Yeah. I remember sending you a, it was like a 6-panel comic in Spanish about, it's a case called the, I think the Army of the Humanoids, in which this one witness sees like this line of humanoids get out of this UFO and start just like marching off in a certain direction. And, you know, we were talking about like how this style is so cool. And then it's just like, hey, what if we did this ourselves? You know, what if, you know, we write up a short script for this, pick a case, and then, you know, you illustrate it. And it turned out to be Welcome UFO People. That's it, like it, that's the simplicity of how all of this, like anything that I've ever done, what's so great about it is it starts with a simple concept. Because for me, one of the joys of kind of diving into these cases is seeing these illustrations that some people do for these cases. And one particular journal that I've come to really enjoy is it's called Canadian UFO Report. And it was around from like about the late 60s, like 69 to about 80, 81. And, you know, devoted, you know, mostly to Canadian sightings, but, you know, they printed stories from the States and other places. But one of the great things that they always included were these like full splash pages of illustrations from two particular individuals. One of them is a guy named Brian James, and the other is a guy named Hal Crawford, and two distinctly different styles. Brian James kind of has a little more of a kind of realistic feel to what he's doing, whereas Hal Crawford definitely leans into more of the science fiction-y aspect of it. And the both of their illustrations in those issues are just, I share them all the time online. One of them I just shared on Instagram the other day. It's one of my favorite pieces, and it's from a case called the Rosedale Humanoids case. And okay, it's this woman named Esther Clappison, who she's kind of living in this remote area, I think, of Alberta. And she goes outside, sees, they call it a square or rectangular kind of object.
Okay.
But realistically, what it looks like is kind of like, you know, this portal doorway that's kind of opened. Mm-hmm. And there are these, she can see inside it, and there are these figures that are looking out. And there's another one, maybe about 10, 15 feet away from this object, grabbing something from the ground. And like the way that Brian James illustrated this thing is like, it's one of the most beautiful nighttime pieces I've ever seen in anything. Oh, like, so regardless. Cool. Yeah, regardless of whether it's like, you know, a UFO case or not, it's just like an absolutely beautiful piece. And I think about these art pieces and I'm like, it'd just be so cool to do something like that. And yeah, when you go through these cases and you see that there are no illustrations for them, never been done at any time, I'm just like, that case deserves that. And you know, with our most recent one that we released, the Dan Duggleby robot encounter one, is it's so like whimsical and strange, because he, you know, he's out hunting in the hills of Bozeman, Montana, and he sees this rocket land, and he sees these robots get out with like forearms, and they're collecting samples of all different kinds, and you've read the source of where it comes from, and it's like, it's from the FBI's files, and it's like, why is there no more on this case? Why is there nothing else? So it's just like, it only makes sense to illustrate it. So
totally,
we did that.
That's beautiful, and that answers one of the main questions I was going to ask, was how you pick the cases. Because for some behind the scenes, we have a folder where Rob has a couple scripts for me preloaded so that I can kind of pick away at them as I have time in the background. And you know, it's one of those things that this is a passion project for both of us, so we're kind of, that's why I loved when you came up with the idea of just having it be like 5 panels or 6 panels, nice and short, and like doing it once a month. It was very manageable. That's, I have the problem with like biting off more than I can chew a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. And with projects like this, I have the knee-jerk instinct to be like, all right, let's do a full comic book and let's like, and like, but this is way better because I feel like it's going to like, I can really take my time with each page, and it's been really fun to kind of challenge myself to work in a different style than I am normally working in. And so one of the things that I love is, and I've always loved about your podcast in general, is how visual of descriptions that you use. And is the source material, like, is the Canadian, what was the
Canadian UFO report?
Yeah, is that using those descriptive language like you're using? Like, do you think that's what they're giving to the artist for them to create these images, or do the artists actually get to talk to the witnesses at times, or do you know how any of that works?
Yeah, so most of the time when it comes to it, the investigators, they talk to the witnesses, they get as much information as they can. And one of the things that I try to do with the podcast specifically is, when it comes to detailed descriptions of either the UFO or the humanoids, I like to kind of verbatim quote what the witness says, because that's really the best picture that you have. Yeah. And it's always so great to see witnesses draw their own things, because, you know, they're not artists by trade, but you can see like they're trying their best, and some of them really surprise you with what they have. And like, one of my favorite cases is the David Stevens case. And it's this case in which this guy and his roommate were home one night. They had an evening off, and they hear this explosion outside. So they go outside, investigate it, realize it's nothing, but they get this odd sensation that they want to go for a drive. So they go for a drive, and before long, their car is taken over by this weird force that starts, you know, maneuvering them down these back roads. And it leads them to a field where this UFO lifts up and comes in front of this vehicle that's sitting in the road. And there's this period of like missing time. And eventually the UFO kind of flies off. The guys drive away. The UFO kind of pursues them for a little bit. And they go down to this one lake called, I think it's like Eagle Lake or something like that. And they see these like miniature UFOs flying all over the place. Like, there's a lot of components to the story. And then eventually the lead witness goes under hypnosis, and he talks about how he was taken on board this craft. And the beings that he has interacted with, in this case, has influenced me so much that it was included in the logo for my show now. It's like he described them as these like 5 foot tall beings with mushroom shaped heads with big eyes that kind of slanted and went upward. Yeah. It's like a very strange sight, but like you look at the original kind of drawing that he made, and like the head is kind of like almost like a half circle in a way, but mm-hmm. like almost it kind of like the way you drew it kind of makes me think of like a hammerhead in a way. And then you have the professional sketch done by a woman named Shirley Fickett, and it's like arresting to look at it, because it's just it looks completely, you know, science fictiony and everything. But like, wow. that was kind of the first case that like made me think of these like sketches and stuff like that. But like, when it comes to what these witnesses have seen, it's you know, most of it is just drawn from the stuff that they're saying, and they're trying to put it into terms that, you know, could be easily understandable to them, and isn't always, but it's interesting to see what those sketches end up being like. And for instance, like with the first installment that we did of Welcome UFO People on the Paulo Satano Silvera case, there's this one iconic image, and I wanted to see you do it so badly, and you did it so freaking well. Is there's this one image of, it's Paulo Satano, he's inside a room, and there's this beam of light coming down at him, and above him is this plank. And there's a little tiny humanoid walking across this plank. It looks like, you know, some trippy disco, like on a UFO. Yes. In a way.
I remember that when you posted that from the original episode, and yeah. just being like blown away, because like they almost like, one of the things that I've noticed is they almost look like instruction manual illustrations. Yes. Like they have like figure one and figure, like they're very like scientific almost a lot of the times. And that's what that, I love that about it. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, you're good. But like what you're saying there, have you ever seen the show Resident Alien?
Yeah, totally.
It's like the beginning title sequences in that, because it looks like an instruction manual.
I never put that together. That's so funny. That's dead on.
yeah. But like, folks, if you've never watched Resident Alien, seriously, it's one of the best shows that I don't think gets talked about enough. But you know, it's literally about an alien that comes to Earth with a mission to destroy Earth, and he starts to become more and more human as he tries to blend in, in order to retrieve like parts from his ship that had, you know, blown off. But like, in there are these title sequences at the beginning that look like an IKEA manual of how to be, you know, blend in with humans. And like, they're always funny because, like, you know, it's like these funny images of like normal circumstance, normal situations, but like, you know, pushed to the absurd. Like, you shouldn't do, like, you shouldn't, you know, like try to eat a baby or something like that. You know, it's just like, you know, normal human stuff. But like, for an alien, it's just like, you know, here's the manual. This is how this works.
You need to know this. That's so good. That's awesome. So, yeah. You answered the big question as far as, like, you know, what leads you to pick these cases for us to do, as far as, and I love that idea of picking ones where there's not as much visual representation and you're like, mm-hmm. this needs to be illustrated. I think that's super cool. And like, as far as like the illustrators that you've mentioned before previously so far already, like, are they, do you, can you follow them? Like, are they still public figures? Are they working? Or is it the type of thing where they just kind of disappear or may not be with us anymore, I guess? Or
yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure if they're still with us anymore. Like, they may not be, but like, it's another like influence on like wanting to do a project like this is a guy named Otto Binder. He wrote books about UFOs and stuff, but like the main thing that he was known for is that he was an illustrator back in the day, and he used to have a daily newspaper comic called Our Space Age. Whoa. And in it, like, for about the first maybe decade that he was doing it, it was all about like space exploration and stuff like that. But more and more, he started to do these like UFO cases and stuff like that, to the point where he was devoting like a week long, you know, to like certain subjects. Like, he did one on, I think it was like the 1967 flap, and he did one on the 47 Whoa. Flap, and he did. He devoted some to like New York sightings and other states and stuff.
That's
and
so
and like
cool.
Yeah, and they're just these like one, you know, one tiny panel illustrations with some text under it. And like, for like, I can only imagine for some people, for the papers that carried it, it is you know, what it would, how like joyful it would be to see that. And like, the cool thing is like, I've been able to find a lot of them on newspapers.com, just like through through them, and I clipped a bunch of them, and they're fun to share online and stuff like that. But like, there are a lot of like sketches and stuff that is, that just like, for someone who like me, who doesn't really have that artistic bone in his body, it's just kind of like a dream come true to do a project like this, you know?
No, absolutely. It's just this brief conversation so far has made me wonder about like all of the artists that have been lost to like history and this stuff, like all the people that have contributed these illustrations to these small zines. Like, what is the when did UFO zine culture start? Do you know, like, as far as like, did it have a big like DIY movement in the 80s, like the music scene did and stuff? Or are you familiar with that at all?
Yeah, like a lot of the old school zines started to pop up in like the early 50s. Like, there was one of the OGs was called Space Review, and you know, a lot of it was devoted to kind of like you know, space exploration and stuff like that. But they also devoted a fair amount of space to you know, UFO cases and stuff, and that was affiliated with the International Saucer Bureau, which is kind of one of the first groups, you know, that was formed. Yeah.
And that's like a privately funded group, right? Like, these are all privately funded operations, and like, at no point were they getting like publishers involved and stuff, right? Like, these are people that are just making them because they really care about the content.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically. And like, you know, even like Alan Greenfield, who's kind of like having the second life on Twitter these days, he was heavy into the zine scene. You know, he helped put out a bunch of zines back in the day. So it just kind of evolved into a lot of UFO journals started to pop up around this subject. And a lot of them are digitized now, which is fantastic. The archives for the Anomalous have like digitized a lot of these old issues. And like that's where I found Canadian UFO Report, because you know, in reading some of the sources, I'd find references to it, and I'm like, this seems like it would be a fantastic publication, but like, it's hard to find. It's hard to find copies on eBay.
Yeah.
I have like maybe one copy that I managed to find, but they digitize a lot of this, and starting in around the 60s, you started to see more UFO sketches kind of appearing in UFO journals, especially Flying Saucer Review, as they started to carry more reports of humanoids. For a while, at least until about the late 50s, humanoids didn't really... There weren't a lot of reports of them. People didn't report them a lot of the time, and UFO journals didn't carry them a lot of the time, just because they're like... as fantastic as they are. But like, once you start to get in the 60s and things start to get a little weirder, especially around 65 and stuff, you start to see a lot more like of that type of art in those UFO journals. So, you know, from about the 50s to about 64, 65, the journals are kind of a bit tame, but like after that, you see like just like fantastic UFO sketches.
That's awesome. Has anybody, and maybe this is a project that we should tackle at some point, but has anybody collected these and done like a really nice like book of like it? Like, I'm picturing like a coffee table book of these zines, like, you know, of like a really nice printed collection that like you
right
flip through and stuff. That'd be so cool. Are the digitizations like high res, and or are these things just kind of
yeah, no, they are fantastic. Like a lot of the sources that I pull from are these digitized like UFO journals. Cool. Like you know, for this week's episode, quite literally, I pulled from Canadian UFO Report, Volume 2, Issue Number 5. And it is the story was so fantastic that I messaged you this morning, and I'm like, dude, we got to make this the next one, because it's poorly under, you know, illustrated. There's only kind of like one illustration associated with it, but there's like a small handful of photographs of the area where all these sightings took place. But in this issue, they gave page space to a witness, which they never usually do. Like, you read these UFO journals, it's people send in their stories, and these folks write it up, put it in there, and that's it. But like, this woman, whose name is Bernice Niblett, she lived in this one room cabin in this island in British Columbia called Keats Island, and she's a badass. She was out there like living on her own. She was installing stovepipe and stove and yeah, and all this stuff, and she starts having these like UFO experiences. But what makes it so fascinating is how she kind of justifies what she's seeing. She puts things into like a human perspective at times, and the way that she talks about these things is that, you know, they're almost like animals, like checking her out, doing what she's doing. Yeah. But the story is just so fantastic. I'm like, yeah, we got to do this one.
I'm so down.
Yeah. And like you have the harder job, because most of what I have to do is like, okay, how do I picture this in my head? How do I write it down? And let Todd do what Todd does, because what Todd does is so fantastic, and I know he's going to bring it to life. And like, you capture what I'm seeing in my head very well, because I can see it in your art style and know how it's going to turn out most of the time, because I, you know, just so familiar with it. And
totally.
And, every day. So it's just like, okay, how I'm picturing this. How's Todd going to draw this? So write it down. The words are kind of my thing. So I put the words in there and that's it. Like, it takes you longer to do your part than it does mine. Mine usually, I'll like stew on something for maybe like 2 hours, mm-hmm. at the most, but, put it in there, send it off. And then, you know,
if I had to do what you do, it would take me so long. Like if I had to like take a article or an experience or a story and distill it down and like break it down into 5 pounds, like that's where I don't excel, because I get so caught up and I'll end up being like, well, this will be 4 pages now, or this will be like, I have a real bad trouble. And like one of the things that I really appreciate about what you do is it's very easy to follow, where I feel like I would definitely, it would be a lot more convoluted, if that makes sense. Like, so I'm real excited to be working with you on this. And I think that we're going to make some really cool stuff, because, I mean, we're only 2 in and I feel like we're already finding a really nice groove, and I'm very excited by the populated folder. And so when you messaged me and said that we're bumping this one up for next month, I was like halfway through the episode from the day, and I had already been like, oh yeah, that's perfect. When you posted the picture of that cabin that Bernice was living in, I was like, holy shit, like how do you do? And you said that she moved in before, it wasn't like winterized or anything, like that's crazy. Like I can't imagine,
right?
And yeah, and this is the one with the barrel shaped UFOs, right? Like that was her. Yeah, that thing is wild looking. And there was another encounter you posted that has a similar UFO to that one.
Yeah, when they published her story, and then like a couple of issues later, they published this article called Four Faces of Our Visitors, which is an article devoted to kind of unusually shaped objects. And one of the things that Bernice talked about is like she kept seeing these barrel shaped objects. She called them red flashers. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of cases in the books that have similar structure to objects. One of them is incident called the Sanina Landing, involving this woman named Rosa Lottie, and she was out gathering carnations for she was making an altar to I think it was like I forget who she was making the altar to, but she was grabbing these carnations and she comes across this object that looks like the way that she described it is that it looked like two like old school kind of like candle snuffers from back in the day.
Oh, wow.
Joined together, but it has that very distinct barrel shape. So and she sees these two small humanoids that are very dapper in the way that they're dressed. They have like capes on too, which is like kind of funny, but they basically steal some of her carnations right out of her hand, and then they try to present her with like this package, but she runs away because she fears that they're gonna take her picture, which is always hilarious to me, because there are these encounters that people have where they talk about the fact that they think the aliens are about to take their picture.
Yeah.
Which is always, it's funny to me, because I don't understand how they get to that thought. It's like, they're aliens and they're here to take your picture.
I think we talked about that on when I was on your episode the last time, and that's so true. It's so funny. And you posted that painting of this encounter that was one of my favorite things. Was that by one of the two artists that you mentioned earlier?
No, I think that was, I don't know who ended up doing that, but that was like you don't see a lot of paintings like that for encounters like this. That, like, that's a rare one that somebody made, but it's also kind of iconic.
Yeah.
To the point where you know, it is one of those few ones that did get illustrations like that. There's another guy that he did a lot of paintings of famous UFO cases. His name was Michael Bueller. And
okay, that sounds familiar. Have you talked about him before?
I might have mentioned him at one point, but if you Google Michael Bueller UFO art, there are so many famous cases that he has painted. Painted the Travis Walton incident. He's painted the Lonnie Zamora incident. He's painted Kenneth Arnold. Just about any famous UFO incident that you can think of, he's painted it. And he did it for decades. And they're really fascinating kind of paintings. And I think he died in 2009. But that's his legacy, is . He's a really famous painter, but he painted all of these famous UFO encounters over the years.
I don't blame him. There is so much to be inspired by and just kind of tap into there, for sure. That's awesome. Yeah. I just did a quick Google, and I'm going to have to go down a rabbit hole of that later for sure. Did you, not switch subjects completely, but did you read comics growing up? Were you into comics and stuff as a kid or later in life?
I was a little bit when I was a kid. Every now and then I would get pick up a Batman comic or something like that off the rack. It wasn't until the mid 90s that I kind of got into Iron Man a little bit, and I got into Iron Man probably one of the worst ways you can get into Iron Man, and that's through the cartoon series that they had in 1996. So
I vaguely remember that cartoon.
Yeah. So 96, there's this double feature that they had on Saturday mornings where it was Iron Man and it was the Fantastic Four, and the main villain in these stories was the Mandarin. And remember every week getting those comics. And then after that, we would take, when we would go to Lake Placid, for instance, we'd go over to the dollar store, and the dollar store had these old comics that they would repackage and sell. And I would buy some of those too. So around the mid 90s, I got really into comics. And then probably in the last decade and a half is when I really started to enjoy them the most. There are certain comics that I reread every year, Joe Hill's Lock and Key. One of my absolute favorites. Oh, yeah. I reread that all the time because it's just so the magical realism of that is just so wonderful. Totally. And it's, Gabriel Rodriguez's art is just so fantastic in that. A couple of winterish comics that I reread every year. One of my favorites, Jeff Lemire, he did The Complete Essex County, which is it's such a beautiful story because it's this kind of generational saga in Canada that kind of is wrapped around this one bird that observes it all, and it takes place in this one small, tiny, tiny, tiny town. And the way that it ends is so damn beautiful. The last two page splash is so beautiful. And awesome. The other one that I like to reread is Craig Thompson's Blankets, because it's you're cozy kind of winter read. It's 500 pages long, but like you can read it pretty quick. And, you know, it's there are a lot of themes to that, you know, living in the cold that you can definitely, you know, pull from and stuff. But yeah.
Oh, yeah. Blankets was one of those books that I read and I was like, oh, this is, that is something special. Like that is like, and Greg Thompson's actually one of the few cartoonists. I keep a book. I just talked about this with my buddy Robin, but I keep a book called Conversations. That's Craig Thompson and James Kocholka just having a conversation in comics, essentially. It's like a little square zine almost. And like, it's one of my favorite formats to, like, that plays with sequential art, and they do it so good. I, excuse me, I've been meaning to pick up the new Craig Thompson book that came out a little while ago that I have still not picked up, because it's one of those things that's a commitment. And now with kids, my reading goes from like, I probably get like 10 pages a day maybe. Like comics I get like maybe 20, maybe I can get like a full 24 page issue in, but it's not nearly as much as it was before. Read lots of children's books these days, which is not far off. Like if you, there's some beautiful children's books out there, and like I've been heavily inspired by a lot of the different artists, and like the one of the things that I like is the writing. A lot of the time I'm like, oh, I think I can do this, and that's probably pretty evident in a lot of my work, because I'm like, yeah, just write it like a kid's book, because that's what you read all the time. And I don't know, but comics will always hold just such a special place in my heart. And I wasn't like, I kind of missed the 90s comics thing myself. Like my main, like, you know, my main access to Batman in the 90s was the animated series and stuff like that. And that was my Batman growing up way more than anything in the books. And then like in high school and right after high school, I got into a group that made comics and educated me and gave me like Swamp Thing and Alan Moore's run on Swamp Thing and like Dark Knight Returns and stuff like that. And I was like, oh wow, okay, this is like a whole nother level. And ever since then, I've never looked back. And I mean, honestly, at this point, I just look at comics way more than I read comics. Like I pull like treasuries of the like the EC treasuries are probably my go-to. Like any of the pre-code horror science fiction stuff, like all the Wally Wood and all the Ray Bradbury translated stories, like I can just stare at that artwork forever. And like it's just because I look at it and I'm like, I still don't know how they did that. Like I still just don't know how you make lines like that. And how, and like it's funny because like stories and stuff have come a long way. Like I would take modern stories like from Blankets or from Jeff Lemire, like any of those, like over most of the classic like EC horror science fiction stories and stuff, because it's just way different. But like there's something that's so special and raw about the way that those comics look, and I love how like cheap they were and how like they were kind of like garbage culture. Like no, like none of the like artists like wanted to be doing that. Like they, like the ones that wanted to be doing it, like made something really magical, but almost all of them, like, I mean, Wally Wood's a great example of it. Like they wanted other things. Like they wanted fame and like, you know, they just, it wasn't there anymore. Like you couldn't be a famous illustrator at that point easily. But I'm really glad that's the way it went, because they made some of the most beautiful art without knowing it. But yeah, I mean, I've talked about seeing originals from them so many times, because it's so gorgeous to me how like they just didn't really care about the original artwork in the way of like preserving it. Like some of the cardstocks weather different than others, because they'll cut out panels to paste over mess ups, and like the whiteout won't like age well because it's not archival. Yeah. And like, but it's just so cool looking, and like, it's definitely influenced me a lot. And this is one of those things that I feel like I get to really lean into that kind of vintage aesthetic purposefully.
And like you do it so well, you put a spin on it that is uniquely your own, and like everyone just like turns out so fantastic, and like it has that vintage style to it, but it's uniquely yours, which is also very modern, so it blends in well together, like really well together. And like we're also talking about, you know, cases that are just old. Like, they've been around for a long time, and it's like we're giving them new life and maybe even life that they never had to begin with. Like, I don't think Dan Duggleby's encounter ever had a life before this, but like, hey, you know, you stumble onto something and you find value in it. And, you know, I think that's what's great about this project is like, you can look at the stories that have been illustrated to death, and you can kind of let those fall by the wayside, knowing that sure, they have a life of their own, but like there's a lot of stories that don't. And it's really cool to be able to do that, to be able to give life to these stories that maybe never had that before, or only had kind of a small readership and stuff. And like, that's what I love to do with my podcast, is just tell these like really obscure stories. Most of the time it's what the Kryptonaut guys do very well too. It's like, you know, finding these stories that aren't as popular in whatever, you know, kind of, whether that's UFO culture, cryptid culture, or whatever, and give them the life that they deserve and give them the recognition that they deserve. And, you know, that's, it's a humbling thing to first and foremost, but like, you always kind of want to root for the underdog, and it's kind of like we give the underdog their due in these comics.
Totally. No, that's beautiful. And I agree completely. I'm very proud of what we've done and the little time that we've been doing it. And I'm excited to keep it going. I think that there's one thing that I always wonder, and I want to ask people like you or Rob or others that have looked, like, is there just an endless well of this stuff? Like, is it could you do Our Strange Skies for a billion years at this point?
You know, there's a lot of stuff out there that I just feel like people didn't know existed. And then all it takes is one person to tell you that this exists. Have fun, kid. Get lost in there for a while. And there were some people that basically, they drop certain sources at my feet. And the one thing about kind of UFO investigators, most of the time they don't share materials very well. And one of the things that I like to do is make sure that like anybody that wants to check the stuff out that I use has the ability to do that. So I put links to everything in the show notes and stuff, but like one thing that I'm really proud of that we have on OurStrangeSkies.com is this resource page. And in this resource page is like most of what I use for the episodes that I do. Like, some does come out of books, not as many, because for me, I'm a slow reader. So I need something that's a little shorter that I can sink my teeth into, that I can generally put into an episode. And if it's kind of worthy of diving deep and, you know, getting your hands on a book to really give it the full space, I'm all for it. But like, these journals are kind of like the lifeblood of obscure cases. And that's where a lot of them sit. But like, there's also this element to the fact that these folks that worked on this stuff and wrote this stuff, they put all of this time and effort into documenting all this stuff. And to kind of appreciate it again is like rewarding, because you're finding all sorts of fascinating and interesting stuff that somebody decided was worthy to put in an article or on an index file, or, you know, something that somebody could read down the line. And, you know, Archives for the Anomalous are kind of the superheroes in this, because they've scanned and put up so much these days. Like, you can get lost on their website just going through old articles and stuff that they have scanned and put on there, you know, for everybody to enjoy. And, you know,
that's like, amazing.
Yeah. That's kind of what we're kind of an extension of that in a way. In what we do is, you know, kind of turn it into something, which is, you know, it's cool to be able to express something that is so hard to express in a way that people can enjoy and understand, you know?
Absolutely. No, I think that's kind of... There's a artist that I like a lot who says something like, he talks about his work where he's like, I'm not saying anything original. Like, all of my ideas, I'm just repackaging. And the thing is that the way I package it might click with one other person that it didn't click with before. So, like, mm-hmm. I feel like what we're doing is taking for the people that like that aren't going to go through the effort of going to the UFO journals and reading those little tidbits, and we're giving them a little bit of a more visually stimulating way to consume it or something. But I also do kind of love the idea that, like, the more that you tell and retell these stories, that you are like re-imbuing the kind of wonder in them all, and like you're kind of like keeping that magic alive by retelling them. And I think that I'm really excited that we get to kind of take these more obscure cases and do something really imaginative with them, because it's something that I, you know, I've always been a consumer of this stuff. Like, I've always been on the listening end of your podcast or the Kryptonaut podcast or all these weirdo podcasts that I listen to all week. And I feel like I take so much as far as inspiration and just kind of, you know, things like, almost all my drawings are little tidbits of things that I take from other people that are smarter than me that have podcasts and things, and just kind of, I amalgamate them and put them through a filter that is my brain, and it comes out with whatever it comes out like. But I feel like this is almost a way to give back and be like, okay, like, I, you know, I enjoy doing this and it's super fun, but I like that, like, we're both kind of giving our time without expecting anything of it and just doing it because we feel like this is something that should be done and is fun to do and want to share it with people. So yeah, that rings true throughout everything we've been talking, from the zines to experiencers, archiving and digital scanning, all of that. Like, it's all thankless.
Yeah, it is, but like, it's an expression of something that meant something, you know, deeply to someone.
Yeah.
To the point that it was worth writing down. And like, when you think of like art, like even going back to like, you know, cave paintings and stuff like mm-hmm. that, somebody wanted to document that and they put it in a place where it was going to be protected, where it wasn't going to be exposed to all of the sunlight and be destroyed. And like, that's the nature of art, is that there is always going to be something worth documenting in that way, worth expressing in that way. And like, you know, this is just another form of it. And it's like magical, it's whimsical, it is otherworldly. And, you know, it's their experiences. These are experiences that people have had. And like, you know, honoring the experience is, you know, something that I think we all do when we, you know,
yeah,
whether we, you know, draw or, you know, do release podcasts, write books, like we all pay tribute to it in some way. And like, this is one way that we've chosen to do it. And it may be thankless, but it's... it's beautiful in that.
Yeah.
And like.
And totally. Mm-hmm. And I don't think what we're doing is particularly thankless. I guess I was more referring to like the archival work and scanning all mm-hmm. the stuff and that right. those are that is the thankless, the part of all of that. But I do think it is special to do it in the way that we get to do it and the way that you do your podcast, where like, a lot of the artwork that's revolving around these experiences or stories is kind of darker, and like they hype up the scariness of it, and they, you know, like most of the things that I think of when I think of, like, you know, aliens and comics and stuff is not just like straightforward documentation of encounters. I mean, there is a few examples of that for sure, but like I like the idea that we get to make these without putting, like, you know, negative tones in there, or like having to make it superficially scary, if that makes sense, or, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, with the Dan Duggleby one, like, you put your own spin on it. You made those robots smiling, which, you know, if you read Dan Duggleby's the little Humcat entry that it pulled it from, it's kind of just like plain and to the point. You know, Dan Duggleby in the hills, Bozeman, Montana, is hunting, hears this whooshing sound, sees a weird rocket that lands, and these robots get out. And like, most of these encounters are like to the point, and they are emotionless, and like, they're, it's so weird because like, they're documented human experiences, and often the human aspect of like the emotion and everything is often devoid of them, because they're not trying to display that. They're trying to give you a straightforward kind of story, and what you're able to do is like make it magical, make it whimsical, make it, you know, something that is a little more expressive than the original accounts are. And like, I think that's like one of the best parts about it, is like how we can kind of spin it into and make it into something that is, you know, that isn't necessarily negative, and is kind of wonderful to observe. Even if like the witness is scared in that moment, there is some sense of wonder that you can pull from, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I never want to, I'm trying to think of a good word for this, but I never want to like whitewash the fear or the experiencers, like, you know, like the world view and feeling that they brought away from those. But I do think there is a theme of wonder and positivity in these things, and especially especially in the reconsumption of the mythology, if that makes sense. Like, if you're going to reconsume all of this stuff and just pull away that, like, you know, the government's hiding aliens and that there's 9 million races of aliens coming to get us, and like, oh, like, what's the point? Like, like, what's like, to me, it's just the wrong thing to pull from it all. And I mean, I don't want to criticize what anybody takes from personal experiences, and if that's someone's personal experience, that's totally valid for their life. But like, at the same time, as a consumer, and that's the thing, like, I think about this stuff a lot, like, this is all being put out there through, or a lot of what we're talking about is being put out there through giant medias, and like things in which are being consumed with, like, you know, scored music undertoning or underscoring weird parts and making things more dramatic. And like, you know, or like, there's that aspect, and there's the aspect that you're talked about a lot where, like, you know, they play the UFO thing on the news and put the X-Files theme underneath of it. Like, there's always these, like, you know, cult, like, so it's nice to kind of get a chance to put our own spin on it and have it be like, I'd much rather it be that than the darker side.
And yeah, you definitely, you know, don't want to take away from anybody's experience. And I don't think we, you know, will ever do that. But it's just like, there's always more than one side, and the unexplained is scary. There's no doubt about that. But hindsight's always 20/20. And, you know, oftentimes that you'll read witness accounts and like, there's just like odd things that don't make sense. They're absurd. They don't make, they shouldn't even belong in what they're saying, but they're there and they're kind of worth documenting. And like, for instance, with Bernice and her experiences, is like, she really, in her writing, she tries to relate things in the most human possible way, like relates these UFOs in the most human possible way. And it's like, it's at one time, like kind of funny, but at the other time, it's like, you totally understand it because like, it's the only perspective that you have to describe what you're seeing. And yeah, it's the only way that you can kind of make sense to it, to the point where you're not necessarily describing an alien craft from somewhere, but you're describing an animal that has taken an interest in you. And like, that's kind of, that's, there are pockets of that kind of wonderful, whimsical thinking when it comes to these things. And there are moments that are like, just kind of like, and like heartwarming in certain ways. Yeah. Like, you know, the Herbert Schirmer incident, for instance, it's an alien abduction that took place in 1967. And, you know, Herbert Schirmer was a patrolman in Nebraska, and he's out late kind of checking on things, and there's a UFO that stops him in the middle of the road, and this being gets out, comes up to his window. And at the time, you know, Schirmer is, he's kind of paralyzed, he can't really move, and like the being escorts him out and escorts him into his ship. And this being asks him, "Are you the watchman for this town?" And he's like, "Yeah, I am." So he starts to, this being kind of shows him around his ship and stuff. It's whimsical. Like, why would you stop a UFO in the middle, or stop a car in the middle of the road to bring a guy on to show him around your ship? And like, the way that Herbert Schirmer tells the story, because there is an audio recording, and it has been turned into a comic book by a guy named Michael Jasorka. It's called December 3rd, 1967. It's a great comic.
I have that out
myself. Yeah, it's you can buy it from him on eBay. He just sells copies on eBay, and it's available on Comixology and stuff. But awesome. While he's on board this ship, and like this being is showing him around, and he keeps saying, "Come with me, Watchman. Come with me, Watchman." They go to this window where he sees this antenna on the UFO kind of drawing electricity from nearby power lines, and the being turns and looks at him and says, "Watchman, you will one day see the universe as I've seen it." And like, to me, that is one of the most, like, that one hits you in the gut. Like, that's an so alien good. Took you on board a UFO and told you that. Like, that's...
Yeah. Like how... No, that's gorgeous. Like, I have goosebumps from that. That's amazing. I love stories like that. And I think that is definitely... Yeah, that's wonder-inducing, to say the least.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there are, you know, a lot of these, like, just very strange, whimsical, short encounters that... really, they don't make sense, and you know, people try to relate them as best they can, and those are kind of what this is, what, you know, this comic is good at doing, is bringing to life these whimsical encounters that don't make any sense, but people say that they happen and deserve that space.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. I love that, Rob. I think that's a great place to end this conversation, because that's one of the best stories I've heard in a minute. Everybody can keep an eye out. We're going to be doing this monthly for as long as, I mean, yeah, I just say we got plenty to keep going. And one of the things that I am real excited about is to get a whole bunch of these together and to make a physical book at some point. Like, I really think putting this out physically at some point, once we have enough to warrant that, will be extra special for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing this with me in general, Rob. I'm very honored to be working with you on it, and real excited to keep sharing these fun comics with everybody.
Yeah, likewise, man. It's a joy to, you know, bring these cases to your attention and watching what happens. It's joy every single time, and people are loving it. Everybody's loving
it. Awesome. Well, if anybody doesn't know where to find it, there are high-res downloads on both of our Patreons, and now there is a Welcome UFO People page on Instagram and Twitter you can follow along with. And yeah, if you want more than that, I don't know, just listen to Our Strange Skies. Rob's got so many, so many amazing, weird cases for you to consume. I just went back and listened to the one you did with AP Strange not too long ago before doing my chat with him the other day, and that was so good. Like, that's one of the weirdest ones I've heard in a while. So go check out everything over at the ourstrangeskies.com, and that's up and running, right? Did you just put that back up? Was that what you said?
Yeah, we put it back up maybe like a month and a half ago.
Awesome. Well, everybody go there and check out all this stuff for sure. And yeah, thank you so much, Rob. I super appreciate everything, man.
Thank you, man.
Yep, I'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Media.